The war lasted 13 years, 4 months, and 1 week, from the death of the first American killed in open combat in 1961 until American troops finally left Vietnam this month in 1975. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll talk with one of the very last U.S. soldiers to leave Saigon. Also, Bob Drury, the author of a book about the final harrowing hours. And native Iowan and former Marine platoon commander in Vietnam, Dan Gannon. Gannon's now Vietnam of America representative to the Iowa Commission of Veterans Affairs. That's all coming up right after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. The Vietnam War lasted 13 years, 4 months, and 1 week, from the death of the first American killed in open combat with the enemy in the early 1960s until American troops finally left Vietnam this month in 1975. Here, in a video posted on YouTube, reporter Michael Nicholson on a bridge in Saigon, April 29th, 1975.
Fighting probably a dozen or so, maybe 20 at the most, communists, and yet there they are, they've been there all today. They panicked, and rightly so. The mortar hit right in the middle of the gun on the right, 100 yards away. It killed a lot of people. But now they've gone back to some of their positions. They've left one wounded in the road.
Reporter Michael Nicholson on a bridge in Saigon, April 29th, 1975. American troops withdrew completely from Vietnam on April 30th, the next day. Later in the hour, we'll talk with former Marine platoon commander in Vietnam, Dan Gannon. Gannon is now the Vietnam of America representative to the Iowa Commission of Veterans Affairs. But first, back to talking about those final hours of the Vietnam War and about an Iowan from Marshalltown who was one of the last soldiers killed in action in the war. Joining me now, Marine Corps Security Guard Sergeant Ken Kraus is with us. He's also Secretary of the Fall of Saigon Association, one of the very last U.S. soldiers to leave Saigon. Sergeant Kraus, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, Ben. Good to hear you.
Good to hear you. Also joining us by phone, author Bob Drury, co-authoring with Tom Clavin the new book, Last Men Out, The True Story of America's Heroic Final Hours in Vietnam. Bob, welcome to you.
Thank you, Mr. Kiefer. How are you? Hello, Ken.
I am fine.
Hi, Bob.
Can I start with you, Bob? Set the scene for us. Remind us of what happened in the preceding time up to 1975. We had the Paris Peace Accords signed in January of 1973.
Broken immediately.
What happened that brought us to the point of this very rushed evacuation?
Well, the North Vietnamese just streamed over the borders allegedly guaranteed by the Paris Peace Accords, and at first they were probing. And they could not believe that they were sending out scouts, they were sending out small units, expecting at any moment for the American B-52s to come, for bombs to come crashing down on them. When they realized that the United States had not only lost the stomach to fight in Vietnam, but we were in the middle of a recession, and there was going to be no payment for breaking those Paris Peace Accords, they just sluiced through South Vietnam. I mean, they took over Pleiku. They took over Da Nang. Da Nang was a mess, Ken will tell you. The Marine security guards at Da Nang almost had a shootout with the South Vietnamese army. I'm trying to compress 2 years worth of time here, but as it turned out, and by April 1975, Saigon and parts of the Mekong Delta, the breadbasket of Vietnam, were just surrounded. And believe it or not, this brilliant North Vietnamese general, ill-named General Dung, he still was waiting for the Americans to come in and take on his army. And it just never happened. So Saigon became an island in a sea of chaos. And unfortunately for security guards like Ken Krause, the people in charge there just wouldn't take charge. And so it was left up to a couple dozen Marines to make order out of this chaos, and that's what happened.
Ken Krause, you were a Marine Corps security guard. Now, according to that peace agreement of 1973, within, I believe, 60 days, American troops had to leave Vietnam, but not so with the Marine Corps security guards. Why not?
That's correct. The final combat troops actually left in March of 1973. I believe the date was March 20th or so. Within the Paris Peace Accords was a provision authorizing about 50 or so military members of the U.S. military to remain. They were the Marine security guards at the embassy, as well as the detachments that were in Canto, Binh Hoa, Nha Trang, and then plus the members of the military assistance command that was out at Tonsin Nhut Air Base.
Tell us about your experience. You were one of the last to leave Vietnam as a Marine Corps security guard. Ken Krause, Bob set it up very nicely there. Let's narrow in on those final hours, the final 18 or 24 hours. What were you to do? What was your task?
I was actually on the next to the last helicopter to depart. I wasn't on the final one. Bob's and Tom's book is focused on the last 11 Marines, and they did an incredible job with the story of those Marines. I was in the embassy compound with a group of about 40 or so Marine security guards, and we spent those last couple of days not only destroying all of the communications gear and all of the personnel records, things of that nature, but then we evacuated some 2,000 or so Vietnamese and third country nationals from helicopter landing zones within the parking lot of the embassy property, plus a smaller helicopter pad up on the roof of the embassy. So we spent the first of the actual helicopters landed in the late afternoon of the 29th, and then the evacuation went on nonstop from then until the time that the last helicopter took off, about 7:58 in the morning of the 30th. And shortly after 4 a.m. or so on the morning of the 30th, I looked down into the compound, and my commanding officer, Jim Keane, Major Jim Keane, was passing the word to button up the embassy. And I looked around, realizing that there were still quite a few Vietnamese who were expecting to be evacuated. But we were pulled off the wall and then into the embassy building itself, and the large teak doors were closed behind us, and then we made our way up to the roof, leaving roughly 400-some-odd Vietnamese who had been expecting to be evacuated there in the parking lot.
Bob, Charles McMahon and Darwin Lee Judge were the last two United States servicemen killed in action during the Vietnam War. Those two men, both U.S. Marines, died in a rocket attack one day before the fall of Saigon on April 29th. Lance Corporal Judge, 18 years old, recently deployed from to Saigon, straight from school in Quantico, Virginia, son of an Iowa mailman, an Eagle Scout from Marshalltown. Tell us about the rocket attack in which he died.
In country, what was it, Ken? McMahon had been in a month and a half, and Judge had been in, what, 3 weeks? And Top Valdez, the sergeant in charge, the NCOIC, he wanted to get these kids out of the way. And his thought process was, well, you know what? They're never going to bomb the airport. They might overrun. I'm picking my best men, like Ken. I'm keeping them here with me at the embassy. And if we have to fight our way out of the embassy, we will. But they're never going to overrun the airport because they want to get rid of us. So I'm sending these kids down to the airport with another detachment. And he thought he was getting them out of the way, and lo and behold, on the night of the 29th, rockets started raining down. They came down for hours at a rate of something like 300 per moment. And Darwin Judge, the Lance Corporals, were both in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, I don't want to get too graphic, but they could barely find what was left of their bodies, and it was just a sense of black irony. I mean, the whole day, the whole 48 hours leading up to this was nothing but black irony. Ken describes it well. You can tell he's a Marine. He's very dispassionate, mm-hmm. whereas Whereas, I mean, there were women throwing their babies over the wall, getting caught on the concertina wire. There were the stories that the Marines, such as Ken, have told us, were just heartbreaking. And these were kids. Like Ken said, he was 19 and a half. These were kids who felt that, yes, they were obeying their superiors, but in a sense, they were looking at the people they had promised, who had been our allies for over 10 years, and were leaving them behind. And they knew what that meant, almost certain death, re-education camp. When Darwin Judge and Charles McManus came in, I'm sure that they had no idea that this was going to be the ending. I think of Cabell and Baghdad before that, Bob, and I wonder if this could happen again.
Bob, as you point out in the book, there was puzzlement over the fact that they would deploy these Marines, these new Marines, so late in the war. Darwin Judge, just 3 weeks out of school. Why was he sent?
In a way, it's the bureaucracy of the military. There was a slot to be filled, and he was next in line to fill that slot. There was no nefarious. Nobody was looking to start another war. Nobody was looking to get anybody else killed. There was a slot to be filled. Top Valdez, the non-commissioned officer in charge, had wired Washington, sent telegrams saying, "Do not send any more. We're buckling down. We're getting out of here." MSG's Marine Security Guards were streaming in, as Ken said, from Canto, from Da Nang. Everybody knew we were getting out. It was just a bureaucratic snafu, and it resulted in just such a black exclamation mark on the entire war.
Ken Krause, as you said, you left in the second to the last helicopter, leaving Saigon April 30th, 1975. Your helicopter went to a ship in the South China Sea?
Right. There was a whole 7th Fleet was sitting right off the coast, and the helicopter I was on went out to the USS Duluth, and other helicopters that included our Marines went to the carrier Hancock and other ships. The Marine detachment, along with members of Ambassador Martin's staff, were then flown over to the Blue Ridge, which was the flagship of the 7th Fleet. So with the exception of the Marines on the Hancock, we were all got back together on the Blue Ridge.
Describe the scene on the ship once you landed on the ship in the 7th Fleet.
That part was pretty chaotic because we came directly off the roof of the embassy and were pretty fully loaded. We had to leave all of our personal possessions, all of our packs and everything except the clothes that were on our back, plus some small arms that we were carrying, our M16s and 45s and things of that nature. But so once we got on the ship, you had a bunch of Marines coming on board ship, fully loaded with all these fully armed. And so the first thing they did was disarm everybody and throw all the small arms over the ship. And at the time we landed, they were still trying to deal with this large influx of people who have never been on a ship before and were also quite panicked. So with the crowds, even on the ship that we were on, that was secured with just State Department and Marines, it was a hot rack situation where you'd have, 4 hours in the bed and then you'd be out. So it was this rotating shift like that. It was pretty crazy time with a lot of stress levels of people trying to figure out what went on, what happened. And then that was just kind of at my level. And then, but at Major Keene's level and Top Valdez, and they were going through the process of, what happened? Where's the bodies of Judge and McMahon, who unfortunately had been left in South Vietnam in a morgue a couple miles from where they were killed? And so then that whole process was gone through as well of how do we deal with this whole issue now and move things forward? And just kind of a side note to that, they were repatriated in February of 1976, and were then given proper burials in their hometowns.
Having experienced this, have you reflected on how the Vietnam War and the way in which it ended, in which you took part, colored the wars that followed, the most recent wars? Are there connections between this war and the first Gulf War, Iraq and Afghanistan?
Certainly, the first Gulf War was greatly influenced in terms of letting the leaders on the ground execute the war that was placed in front of them. but I don't know as much about the execution of certainly Iraq and, mm-hmm. and Afghanistan. I just haven't been able to see as much of that. But
just a few seconds left.
Sure, but that's about it. I certainly feel that way in the first Gulf War, but not in the second.
Marine Corps Security Guard Sergeant Ken Krause, thank you for joining us. Secretary of the Fall of Saigon Association, and Bob Drury, co-author, along with Tom Clavin, of Last Men Out, the true story of America's heroic final hours in Vietnam. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we talk with a native Iowan, former Marine platoon commander in Vietnam, Dan Gannon, about the challenges faced by veterans of the Vietnam War and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. After a short break, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. And my next guest is Dan Gannon. Gannon grew up on a family farm near Mingo in central Iowa. He graduated from Iowa State University, then attended the U.S. Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia. Gannon served in Vietnam in the 1st Marine Division in 1969 and 1970 as a platoon leader. While serving in Vietnam, Dan Gannon was wounded. Now he's retired from 30 years as an operations manager at UPS. He is now Vietnam of America representative to the Iowa Commission of Veterans Affairs and joins us for the rest of River to River. Dan Gannon, welcome.
Ben, thank you very much. It's nice to be here this afternoon.
I understand you are called by many Lieutenant Dan. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I'm very proud of that name based on the movie.
Okay, yes, Gary Sinise's character in Forrest Gump. May I call you that?
You may.
All right. I want to talk a lot about your help for veterans, what veterans are experiencing, and the challenges that you help them face. But first, I wonder, what can you tell us about your tour of duty in Vietnam?
Well, my tour of duty, of course, was started in 1969. I was 22 years old, young, as the other guests had talked about. Most of the veterans in my platoons, I had two different platoons based on an injury and a wound while I was there, were in the age of normally 18 to 19. But my tour was 13 months of combat, and the experience was an experience that I would never probably want to do again, but I also was one of the best experiences of my life. And I guess one of the things that I want to say here, and I'll take this from the Iwo Jima Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery, uncommon valor was a common virtue. As it states on that memorial, that was extremely true in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I saw this throughout my tour. I witnessed a year of daily individual bravery and heroism that's been unmatched in any other experiences in my adult life. Bottom line, all Vietnam vets, I feel, fulfilled their military core values, honor, courage, and commitment, and something that all of us Americans need to be proud of.
We all know the horror of Vietnam, but you mentioned also one of your best experiences. Can you tell us about a great experience that you had there that you recall fondly now?
An experience in Vietnam is...
Right? Yeah, you mentioned it was some of the worst experiences, but also some of the best experiences. I'm trying to get at the upside of that as you recall it.
I think when you talk about experiences, you talk about it's hard to talk about the true combat and all that, the blood and the guts that a lot of veterans will talk about. But I guess the best experience I had was just the common in relationships you had with various veterans. I developed a relationship with the two different platoons that I served with in Vietnam, probably a closer relationship than I would have probably with my own family, because you are always protecting each other. You take care of each other. You survive together as a team. You don't do that individually. And that was probably the biggest thing I could take away from Vietnam was just that mm-hmm. personal experience with being that close to veterans that cared about each other.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Dan Gannon, after you were a platoon leader in Vietnam. You served your tour of duty, returned to the U.S. What were your biggest challenges after returning to the mainland?
Well, I did have a little bit of an advantage. I didn't have to come back and deal with the issues that were going on in the U.S. like some soldiers had to. Of course, there was a lot of issues. I had one more year left in the Marine Corps, so I spent my last year at 29 Palms, California. Then when I got out of the service, and you mentioned me as being growing up on a farm, I did some farming for a while before I went to UPS. So I was probably a little bit buffered to a certain degree, but you still had the same issues you had that were talked about at the U.S. at that time. And you dealt with them, I guess, the best way you could, trying to keep it positive. But I always try to stay focused on the veteran that was asked to serve, and the veteran went and served his country proudly.
Mm-hmm. You work so much with veterans now coming back from our most recent wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, veterans suffering from PTSD. Did you suffer from what we now call PTSD when you returned?
Yeah, yes, I have, and I don't talk a lot about this, but I do. I've had health issues. Wounded, I've got some issues with some bursitis. I have some hearing losses based on firefights and combat for 13 months. I had cancer from Agent Orange. And then also through that cancer experience, my flashbacks and nightmares came back at an extremely high rate. And so I had to deal with an issue called PTSD. And through the help of the Veterans Hospital here in Des Moines, I was able to work through that. But I did have some issues with that. But with all those issues, I'm able to work with, whether they're Afghan or Iraq veterans, Vietnam vets, and Korean vets, or even World War II vets, even though there aren't too many of those left. Mm-hmm. But I've been able to work with them based on my own personal experiences.
I wonder, with your perspective, having returned from Vietnam, suffering from PTSD, being treated, as you said, in Des Moines for it, how has our understanding of PTSD, the stresses caused by combat, the causes, how is our understanding of it and its causes now different than when you returned in the early 1970s? Have we made progress there in understanding and in treating it?
Yes, I think we've made tremendous progress. And I don't know if a lot of our listeners even know this, but PTSD wasn't even a formal diagnosis until 1980. So I got home from Vietnam in 1970, and your other war, Civil War, they think they talked about soldier's heart, World War I and World War II. I think they referred to it as combat fatigue and battle fatigue and shell shock. Vietnam, initially, they diagnosed with stuff with like bipolar disorder or post-Vietnam syndrome, so they never really recognized it very well at the very beginning. But in 1980 and then on, it became more and more of an important issue. And I think with the wars today, it is an issue, and we're trying to work through that. One of the things I do want to say there, and I can talk about this later, Ben, but based on time, but is the paradox of PTSD.
Yeah, go ahead and tell us that. Post-traumatic stress disorder, you call a paradox. Why so?
Well, I call it a paradox, and I'm trying to talk about this in every way I can, whatever group I get to talk to. I think a lot of folks don't understand, us Vietnam vets, and I know the Afghan and the Iraq veterans do understand, is the experience coming home or the experience in combat, with a combat deployment, especially if you served in combat, is extremely complex. For example, some of your issues is hyper alert, anger, depression, anxiety. Well, some of those things, you have to have those skills to survive in combat. Mm-hmm. For example, you have to have the skill of being always alert. So you're hyper alert. You're constantly on the edge. You talk about we have a lot of us have issues with sleeping. Well, in combat, you're trained not to sleep at an extreme deep sleep because you always have to be ready to move at the point of that needs to be. Anger, depression, all those emotions that you have tied up into you, you really can't express that in a combat environment, but you have to control those things. But when you come home, then those issues come out. So it's a paradox because we're treating the symptoms we treat are also the same skills you have to survive in combat.
Dan Gannon is my guest. He is a former Marine platoon commander in Vietnam, 1969, 1970 he was there. And now he is the Vietnam of America representative to the Iowa Commission of Veterans Affairs. I imagine your combat experience, the things that you suffered, the challenges you faced after combat, Lieutenant Dan, help you communicate with today's vets.
Yes, it does. Matter of fact, once veterans understand you were truly in combat and all the issues you've been through, it opens the doors like I guess you wouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. And I've learned that just working with our Afghan and Iraq veterans in the last 3 or 4 years. And they're extremely willing to talk to you because that's what you want. You want that open communication so I can help them with the benefits and claims that they all are deserving. You know, the bottom line, one thing I want to say here is that war changes our bodies. It changes our functions. And the expectation that when you come home, you're just going to reset and be just normal, that just doesn't happen. That's a completely unrealistic thing. And these deployments, these second and third deployments, you're asking veterans to do this, to you come home, just be your normal person, forget about the skills you need, and then but we want to treat you for those skills and then turn around and go back and do it again. And I think that's really causing us a tremendous amount of issues, or will be issues in the future.
Does it depend on the type of person you are, the type of personality you are, whatever you were given at birth or your upbringing, as to the lesser or greater degree to which you'll suffer from PTSD or have to deal with reintegrating into civilian society?
Yeah, that's a very good point, Ben, because, you know, someone said, well, how did you survive combat and how did you do so well? And I said, well, I grew up with 13 brothers and sisters, and I was one of the oldest ones, so I had to be able to deal with them. And I don't know, everybody has their own way of dealing with trauma, whether it's in civilian life or military life. Some folks are extremely sensitive and are bothered by issues, and some aren't. So it's a difficult thing to call. I don't know. I think maybe it was my upbringing. I, for some reason, was able to handle that. But after a point of time, it does create a toll, and then you have to face reality. You have to be able to deal with those issues. And a lot of us don't want to deal with those issues because we want to be just normal.
What can you tell us about when you talk to the vets, veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, what can you say about how their combat experience was different than that of a Vietnam combat veteran?
Well, and this is based on what they tell me. I don't think it's a whole lot different. Now, some folks say what's a lot different, the environment you worked in. In Vietnam, I was in the Marines, which was an I Corps, which is extremely heavy jungle related and a lot of hills and rough terrain. And I know in Iraq, it's more desert. But they still have the same issues. They still have to be able to deal with a combat issue. They still have to be able to deal with the fighting and all their various skills that they have to be able to perform at a moment's notice and do it correctly. And I don't think personally, from what they tell me, there's a whole lot different than what us Vietnam veterans went through.
All right, you're kicked into this hyper aware mode. Your brain is changed from days and days of this, and then coming back to civilian society, it doesn't just return.
Right.
How many veterans out there from our most recent wars or from Vietnam are out there who you would say need help, who are not reaching out, who keep silent?
Well, I think there's a lot of veterans, and I see more and more coming in. I see a lot of Vietnam veterans coming in now, and I think it has to do with our age. They're looking for health care, and it's there. Getting veterans to come in and use the Veterans Hospital and use the VA system is still difficult because, especially when it comes to post-traumatic stress, a lot of them don't want to admit that, and that's kind of how we grew up, and maybe the service had something to do with some of the things we don't want to admit certain things, or a lot of them still feel that if it's found out that they have mental issues, they may have issues of getting hired. And, you know, today a lot of Vietnam vets are looking for jobs, and some of them are having difficulty finding those jobs. So the issues are there, and we'd like to get more and more of men to the VA system process and help them. But that's a continuing going on communication that we're trying to do.
One of the hallmarks of our most recent wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, has been redeployments. You mentioned those. What does that do to the stress on the soldier compared with a Vietnam-era soldier who had, what, is it 18 months and you're out, right?
Basically 12 or 13 months, depending on what service you served in. And in Vietnam, basically everybody served one tour. Now, there's those who went back for more tours, maybe were career soldiers or volunteered to go back. The difference today is about every 18 months, at least with the Iowa National Guard, the ones I'm exposed to, they're back in combat. And that constantly redeployment, I think, is doing tremendous damage to our soldiers. And as I mentioned, to do with the PTSD and the paradox of that. They're asked to when they come back, or to change and to be a civilian, then in 18 months they're back over and they have to have those skills to be able to deal with combat. So I think it's causing serious issues, especially when it comes to families. I think you'll hear that suicides are up with our soldiers, divorce is up. They do a lot of self-medication, whether it's drugs that they get through legal drugs, or it's alcohol, or so on, but it definitely is an issue, and I am really anti all the redeployments that we do, because I think down the road, 20 to 30 years, we're going to see a tremendous amount of issues with our soldiers, as we have seen with Vietnam vets.
How much does the war in Afghanistan, and now it has, I think, exceeded the length of the Vietnam War. Am I correct in that? I'm not sure.
Yes, it has, I think. I think it's the longest war now.
How much does Afghanistan, that war there, our involvement there, remind you of Vietnam?
Well, I guess to a certain degree, maybe not a lot of reminder. It's just the fact that soldiers are serving in a war that I think it's time to put a closure to it. And you heard this about Vietnam. I think we've done what we need to do. It's time to move on and bring our soldiers home.
Mm-hmm. When you talk to soldiers returning from Afghanistan, is that a consensus view?
Yes, it is. But, soldiers will always do what they're told. They went in the service. They signed up to serve their country. They're very proud of that. And if asked to go back again, they'll go, because that's the way we are all made up of. We're gonna serve our country. Just one thing to remember when you're talking with veterans, the veteran's just doing their job and they're doing it honorably. And whether you agree or disagree with the wars, whether it's Vietnam, mm-hmm. Afghan, Iraq, if the only way you can deal with that, you have to deal with the congressmen and senators on trying to close some of that down. But the veteran does serve their country honorably and will always go and serve.
The perception is that Vietnam veterans were treated differently when they returned to the U.S. in the U.S. culture than are the veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. I wonder if you can tell us in what ways you feel returning Vietnam veterans paved the way for helping veterans of more recent wars.
Well, I'll lead into that with this statement. And the statement is Iraq and Afghan veterans are extremely excited and proud of us Vietnam vets. And I hear that all the time, that we took the brunt of the issues coming home. And of course, we weren't treated the best, and that's saying it mildly. And they feel that they get the accolades and the parades and all the hoorahs based on what Vietnam veterans went through. So I think us Vietnam veterans should feel proud of that. We helped them, but we have to hang in there, and we have to help those vets today and not look back on the issues that we dealt with and make sure they're getting treated fairly and very well for coming home and serving their country.
Lieutenant Dan, you are active in helping Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans, U.S. soldiers, in claims for, I understand, medical benefits for services. What are the biggest hurdles you run into? Simple bureaucracy?
Yeah, there's bureaucracy. The issues with filing claims today is this: the system isn't designed to deal with the number of claims. If you file a claim today, you're not going to get a completed answer, completed claim for about 12 to 13 months. That's how far the VA is behind on claims, and that's a sad deal that a veteran served their country, has a health issue, especially ones that do need the financial help in care, and they have to wait a year to 13 months to get an answer on whether they're going to get that.
Mm-hmm. Are we nevertheless doing a better job treating our veterans than in the 70s for returning Vietnam veterans, or is it
Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. We're doing a much, much better job. I think we understand the issues better. And there's a tremendous amount of us that are out there trying to help those vets versus, I think, them when I came home from Vietnam.
You're a former Marine platoon commander in Vietnam. Do you still keep in touch with those who were in your platoon?
I keep in touch with them to a point, but I went over. We didn't go over as a unit like maybe a World War II unit might have. When I went to Vietnam 69, you're basically going over to fill slots that were empty due to casualties and so on. So I've got a few folks that I stay in touch with. I would love to stay in touch with my whole unit, but it'd be very difficult based on the different times that we served, because mm-hmm. there was constantly rotation while you're in Vietnam.
What do you feel are the biggest myths about combat in Vietnam that you think people misunderstand today, or perhaps are popularized in Hollywood films?
Yeah, and I've talked about this before in various talks, and one of the myths is the soldier went to serve their country and really didn't want to, and that's not true. I think if you were to ask a Vietnam vet, in fact, they've done surveys on this, you ask a Vietnam veteran, would you go back and do it again, and they would say yes. It's just like the Iraq and Afghan veterans today. Even though they probably don't want to go back, some of them, they felt they've done enough, they're going to go serve because that's what they are. That's how they're made up of. So that's a myth. I think all Vietnam veterans in general are very proud of what they did in Vietnam and how they served, and sometimes the media didn't spin it that way. Mm-hmm. And the other myth, I think, is the country was never behind the war. The country, I think in some of the surveys, show that the country majority was still behind the war up till about the last days.
Okay, we have just less than a minute. Please remind us about the upcoming Vietnam Veterans Recognition Day, May 7th, the ceremony, and how we can find out more information for veterans.
Yes, on May 7th, and I definitely want to bring this up, especially for Vietnam veterans and all veterans, we have a Vietnam Veterans Recognition Day, May the 7th. It's at 12 p.m., it's at the Vietnam Wall, which is just south of the Capitol. And if you want to know more about this, a great website for all veterans, whether it's that or any kind of benefits, is the Iowa Department of Veterans website, and it's www.iowava.org.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.